Blog Talk Radio.
Talk with Angela Butler. I'm, of course, Angela Butler. For those of you who are just now tuning in or not that familiar with the show, today's guest is Mr. James Costin Jr. Mr. Costin is a speaker, and he also has an institute that he'll be telling you about later on in the show. So, hello, how are you?
I'm doing well, Ms. Butler. Thank you. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm doing okay.
Good.
So I thank you for agreeing to come back on the show. Had a hard time getting up with you close to the end of last year and this year, so I'm glad to have you back.
I'm glad to be back.
Okay. So think about the killings of Black America youth here in the USA.
The killing of youth, period, is just wrong. You know, we really need our kids. But the killing of blacks, teens have been 21 times more likely than white teens, the killings by police. And I think that's just appalling. Of the 1,200 deadly police shootings from year 2010 to 2012, according to the federal data, it shows that blacks from age 15 to 19 were killed at a rate of 31 per million, while 1.47 million were white males. So I just think that those statistics are disproportionate and just appalling.
Okay. All right. I agree with you. You're right about that. So, in relation to incarceration, what is your opinion about mass incarceration of black people here in America?
Well, I have an opinion, and I know we all do. So just this is mine. The trend toward incarcerating black people, black men in particular, started back just after the emancipation of slaves. The chain gang system, where there were laws drawn up that reincarcerated or recaptured black men once they were released from slavery, and the capture process or the incarceration process or the re-enslavement of these men was again enforced by law. So that has basically spiraled out of control to what we have now. Michelle Alexander has penned it, the new Jim Crow. And we see patterns that are similar to the former patterns of using incarcerated people to work for corporations. So there's a big industry around those that are incarcerated. And I think that my opinion about that process or that system is it's just wrong.
It's just wrong. Yes, sir, it is.
Yes.
It is. So let's go in a little further detail. What is your opinion about the criminal justice system, not just mass incarceration, but other things that go on in the criminal justice system? What's your opinion about the United States of America criminal justice system?
Well, the criminal justice system is what it is. You know, you have several components. You have law enforcement, prosecution, defense attorneys, you have the courts, you have corrections. And we can find possibilities of injustice trending badly for black youth in all of these components. Let's just take the law enforcement component of the criminal justice system. There was a study published by Stanford's Journal of Personality and Social Psychology where police were asked directly, who looks criminal, okay? And they would choose black faces more than white faces. And stereotypically, the more the black face appears, the more likely officers are to report that the face looks criminal. And this subjective person perspective cocktail is just volatile. And that's excuse me. And I think that's why you see the confrontation between police and young black men, or police and people, as it relates to the killings and the mistreatment of police. Now, I suggest that the same holds true consistently in all of the components of the criminal justice system, and the decisions made by each respective component leans away from and not towards justice for black youth. So the odds are against black men, black kids, once they actually have an introduction to the criminal justice system. And some would say that it's designed that way so that it fuels the system of mass incarceration or the prison industrial system.
And what you're saying, job security. Am I right?
Say again?
Job security. That's my understanding
you're saying. Yeah, in a lot of ways, yeah. You know, so if you were a policeman and you wanted to make sure that you keep your job, sadly, it means more tickets, more costs, more arrests. And the same with prosecution, same with the court system, same with the defense system, and the same with corrections. And if you want to consider the whole prison industrial complex, you may be talking about job security for those who want to keep their major corporations afloat. I think it's just insane that a person can be incarcerated in the system of corrections and work for a company while incarcerated, but not qualified to work for that company once they are released. And I think that's just something we need to just take a look at and negotiate. We need to negotiate that.
So I understand what you're saying. I know I'm repeating things back, but it's sinking into my own brain too. You're saying that while black folk are in prison, they're allowed to work for corporations. But once they're released from prison, they're not eligible to work for those corporations and to use that as insanity. And you are right.
Yeah, absolutely. That's just appalling. It's just something we need to take a good hard look at and negotiate.
But they're not paid the same wages, are they?
If they get the job while outside, they are getting paid more than they would be inside, of course. But I think that they get a very, very small stipend, if you will, to work for a corporation while incarcerated. Now, if they were to be released and were to apply for a job for the very same company that they work for while incarcerated, studies have shown that many of them do not get the jobs because of the fact that they have this history of incarceration.
Not only is that insanity, that's extremely racist.
Right.
Yes, sir. So I have to ask you this. As a black man, a very intelligent black man, very successful black man, do you think there's a certain way that blacks are seen by police officers? Black men and women.
Yeah.
I know you're not a woman, but I know you may have women friends.
Absolutely. Okay, let's just consider the statistics that I mentioned earlier. Black teens, black kids are in 15-19 are 21 times more likely to be killed by authority, police than white teens. Yeah, it's been found that people were quicker to shoot black men with guns than white men with guns, and to shoot black men without guns if there is any doubt about whether the person is possessing a gun or not. Operating from this narrative, officers strap up according to where they've been called to respond. For example, if you're an officer and you're called to respond to a known black community, yeah, they strap up fully and with Glocks cocked and one in the chamber. While responding to a white community, they respond taser ready. So it's, and I think that a lot of it is subliminal. It's a bias that many of us don't realize we have. And I say us because I have the same bias. When I am dealing with a particular group of people or dealing with a particular company, I have these inherent biases that I carry around, and so I respond accordingly. And so the more that we actually recognize that we have those biases, and then the better the chances we can release ourselves from these biases and treat each other fairly, treat each other with respect and dignity. But until that has been addressed, and you just have this thing going around, that many of us have. Ill feelings about groups of people that we don't really realize we have, and it's been transferred intergenerationally. So it's gotten woven into our nature. Yeah. And I think on the other hand, theory, you can have intergenerational trauma transferred. For example, if your ancestors were slaves, that trauma can be passed down from generation to generation. If your ancestors were slave owners, that ethos of privilege and can be passed on intergenerationally until you get to 2015, a lot of us are walking around thinking that we don't have these issues when in fact we do. And they're so deeply embedded in us that we're not able to recognize it. So, yeah, officers look at blacks a certain way. And to be open and transparent about it, officers also look at whites a certain way too. It's just that blacks fare worse than whites do in their confrontation with the police, with the corrections. Yeah. I mean, not corrections, but the enforcement.
So, in your opinion, what part does the media play the way black men are seen, and the internet too, the World Wide Web, Apple, Kindle?
I thought long and hard about that question. I'm not real sure if I'm totally qualified or equipped to answer that. But I do know this from my observation, I watched the news unfold on Ferguson, and I watched it covered by several news agencies. And then some of the agencies I could not watch. Because the depiction was violence, of fires burning, of confrontation, but there were some news agencies that depicted the peaceful protest, positive that could come from this negative. And I tend to lean more toward that kind of news media coverage. And the other thing that came to mind when I hear this question is that black youth have been persuaded to portray, you know, over the top violence and misogyny by music media. Many of these guys who are banging, you know, these beats with all of this gangster stuff have not lived that life. It's just something that has sold over the years, and the corporations who make money with this media would prefer that music over music that has a more of a positive. So the other thing that I think the media has exploited men, black men, youth, to portray this hatred for women. And so those are the two points that jump out at me when I think about media. You know, like I said, I don't study that much about the media and its impact on us as we see black men portrayed. But I do think, I also want to add this. Over the years, okay, black men have been portrayed as aggressive. Once upon a time, they called this behavior, I think it was cocaine. Oh, what was it called? Cocaine psychosis? No, it wasn't cocaine psychosis. It was, well, black men were given cocaine back in the day, back in the 20s, and even before then, to enhance their performance and working, to keep them energized. And at some point, the mindset changed, and there was this real fear that black men were attacking their white women. And so cocaine, that was the first time that cocaine actually became illegal, okay? And it became a plump. It got to a point where pharmacists could not
prescribe. I hate to interrupt you, but all black men don't thirst and crave a white woman. I mean, I know it sounds racist, but everybody has a preference.
Yeah.
I mean, that's wrong portrayal, because all black men don't want white women. It's like all black women don't want a white man.
Yeah, the most of the race riots of the 20s, the early 20s, late 1800s, early 1900s, most of them started because a white man thought that a black man either whistled to or looked at a white woman improperly. And it doesn't mean that black men did these things. It was just something that was going on in the minds of our white brothers and sisters. So that's an image that has been exacerbated, if you will, by media.
Right, and you're right about the coverage in Ferguson, Missouri. They're showing people that come on TV and say, we don't want them here, we don't want violence, we don't want this. But those people that they didn't want there, who came from different places, are what kept them in the media. I mean, it may not be a good thing, but it seems to me like when there's oppression, like it has been for black people all these centuries, all these years, all these decades, that mm-hmm. sometimes violence does happen when black people, sometimes enough is enough.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Oppression
yeah.
like that, discrimination like that, it has to come out. You get what I'm saying? And sometimes
yeah,
it comes
absolutely.
Out in violence.
Yeah. Yeah.
Doesn't make it right.
Yeah, well, that's a theme that I saw prevalent in this incident in Ferguson. There was a situation that enraged a group of people, including myself. But there was this huge effort at trying to control the response to that enragement or to that injustice, and yeah. It doesn't make it right. I don't think that the responses were totally appropriate. I find it an exercise. If I stub my toe, okay, I'm walking through my house and I stub my toe, I have actually started recognizing that instead of expressing pain, I express anger. Okay, and I think it's a natural response. I think it's a natural response. And just because I've tried to get keen in my feelings and how I respond to those feelings, you know, but we as a society in America, we have a lot of issues that have not been addressed, and so to allow or to expect a group of people to see their shot down and lay on the ground 4 hours and 30 minutes, okay, and just treat it that way and then not and have the officer not have to answer to his wrong. Yeah, that enraged a community of people, and it raised a nation, and actually enraged people from around the world. I liked that fact that it was became a human rights issue, and so as a human rights issue, the United Nations were able to get involved with it. So yeah, that it's just a sad situation, and the media has an impact. The media has an impact, and based on what news agency you watch, it can basically shape your narrative.
Yes. It can. It does. I've had relatives in my family that have been lynched. Not going to call any names or anything, but it's been like within the last 5 or 6 years. I don't talk about it often on the show, but James Merritt, the civil rights, is like was my grandmother's, I think, first cousin.
Oh.
And I grew up hearing a lot of things. But I also noticed something else. It seems like most black people that I have talked to on this radio show and when I go other places have similar stories. I wrote a book called Charles and Melinda by Angela Dolores Butler. And when I wrote the book, before I had wrote the book, I must have met 100 people, maybe 50 to 100 people who had the same story.
Mm.
About lynching, Jim Crow, chain gang.
Mm-hmm.
We all had the same thing.
Mm.
And I have very rarely met any blacks who can say, I don't have an ancestor that was a slave.
Mm.
I mean, if everybody was to write a book, it would all sound the same.
Pretty much the people
I've talked to. Slavery.
Yeah.
And my book is fictional.
Mm-hmm.
My book is fictional.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir. So, what more to the church? Do you like to take a look at my book?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yes,
okay.
sir.
Yeah.
I like to take a look at it too. I've been pushing it. Some people tell me there was some printing problems, so I don't know. I know I wrote it and had it edited, so I don't know why the words were printed wrongly, but on a couple of things, few things. But I hope it doesn't take away from the enjoyment of the reading.
Okay. Okay.
Of my book. What more could the church, in your opinion, the church in America, help do concerning mass incarceration, the killing, the church itself? Because the church, the black church, has always been a source of strength for the black community.
Absolutely. And it's also one of the old, if not the oldest, institution in our community that is still trying to survive. And if the black church, or if the church at large is in fact an open community, redemptive and true to transformation of individuals, foci, it stands to reason that we should rely on the church to take the lead in collaboration with other community stakeholders in order to ameliorate a lot of the issues that we have. That as it relates to mass incarceration, prison ministry must be a paradigm shift in prison ministry. Instead of going to meet the brothers and sisters in church and having a service for an hour, it might be better to do time with someone who is incarcerated. I mean, so right there with the brother and developing a relationship and actually having that brother and sister looking forward to being released to become a part of the family, church family outside those walls.
Okay, so basically my interpretation of what you're saying is that the church should, people within the church, I guess perhaps maybe pastors should get to know someone that is in prison and help them transcend back into the community.
Help them in their transformation while incarcerated. What we've been doing is waiting for people to be released and then trying to help them transform. And you see what that has done. It hasn't really been effective. I'm saying that we touch while a person is incarcerated and walk them through their time.
Okay. All right. Okay. So, Mr. Clauston, what is the name of your institute and what is the purpose of the institute?
Okay. The name of my organization is the James H. Clauston Senior Institute for Complicated Freedoms, Inc. That's a mouthful. But it's named after my father because he was the first generation Clauston who saw the trends of incarceration under the incarceration of black men troubling, and I am the second generation Clauston.
Well, your dad, your father, is that who you're talking about, sir?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was he a vice president at one of the universities?
He was the president of ITC here in Atlanta, Interdenominational Theological Center.
Okay, he was president. Okay, not vice president.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes, sir. Go ahead, Mr. Clauston.
Yeah, and the primary purpose of the institute is to promote collaboration between all community stakeholders to forge our beloved community, and we envision doing that by taking a spiritual lead and moving the community in the direction of social organization. You know, right now I think what we're seeing is a community that is disorganized. So what we have to do to fix that is to organize our communities and turn around these trends of the social justice trends that are debilitating, partner with other major community stakeholders to speak out against social injustices, the advocacy piece. We have to stay in the face of those who, the laws that continue to disempower people, and when that does happen, the last piece that we were just dealing with was we jumped on board with the Ban the Box initiative, if a returning citizen has to answer that question on their application about about their incarceration history. Sometimes that keeps them from getting their feet in the door. And if you can't get your feet in the door, you really can't, you don't have much of a chance. So, yeah, so the Institute is capacity building organization, so that we, so that all of the institutions in a community can start performing a little better, can start understanding what each of our organizations are doing. We have a lot of organizations that are trying to do a piece, but it's such a big problem that we have, and it takes collaboration and it takes partnership. The collection and there's a word I want to use. It takes money, and it takes everybody putting some money in a pot to make some things happen. And as long as organizations don't think that they can help because they don't have the money, a lot of times they end up not doing anything. So just giving organizations an opportunity to at least let them know that there is a way that they can help just by being a part of a collective force.
Okay, Ms. Carson. So it's ran out of time.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Costin. I look forward to having you back. Like I said, I'm sorry it's only a 30-minute show, but I'm doing my best. And thank you. I know someone heard you. And God bless you, Mr. Costin. And, oh, by the way,
thank
I want
you.
To tell you, people have been asking for you to come back on the show, so I just thought I'd
okay.
Yes, sir. Thank
yes.
you.
Okay, thank you, Ms.
God bless you.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye.